Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And a big welcome back to you, Ken, before you say a single thing. Welcome back. Good to have you sitting in that seat where you belong.
Thank you. I missed 1 week.
All right. It seemed more like two, but I guess there is a week that's naturally in
this week's podcast.
2 weeks. This week. Oh, yes.
We'll seem like
yeah,
two.
We'll seem like
we'll
two.
Seem like
two.
But anyway, I have one word for you.
One word for you.
The same one word that President Obama had for the United States of America. Mission accomplished.
Okay, because Osama bin Laden is dead.
Right.
The president was saying,
success
now we
death.
Can leave Afghanistan. But
you
let me
I.
just let me just say this. That speech has played as a withdrawal speech. But while the president may be taking out some of the troops that he put in the last year and a half this year and the rest of those troops in the following year, that's still only a minor fraction of the uniform personnel in Afghanistan, not to mention all of the contractors who are probably more numerous than the uniform
personnel. That's the whole point. The whole point is that by September of 2012, 30,000 troops.
Is there something happening in September of 2012? I'm just trying to remember.
They moved up the election.
No. That's the month that the Democrats are probably going to be having their convention. Is it not, Ken Reardon?
It is. And then at the convention, he'll say, look, I got all the troops that I just put in. But meanwhile, what about the 68,000 troops that will still be in Afghanistan?
Look, there are all kinds of things you can say about Afghanistan. Clearly, it was inherited. Clearly, he had called it, quote, the good war, unquote, the one other than Iraq, the one we should have fought, the one where we should have killed Osama bin Laden. Now that Osama bin Laden is dead, and of course the president did manage to find a moment to mention that in his 13 and a half minutes of remarks on this subject.
We killed Osama bin Laden, the only leader that al-Qaeda had ever known. This was a victory for all who have served since 9/11.
The president is saying, okay, now we can begin to disengage in a way that we couldn't before, and we really do smell success. I believe he actually used the expression light in the distance.
Even as there will be dark days ahead in Afghanistan, the light of a secure peace can be seen in the distance. These long wars will come to a responsible end.
As a Vietnam-era guy, that makes me kind of remember some promises we heard in the past.
But there are more and more questions in Congress from both parties. You know, you could always say that, yes, it's a Democratic president, so the Republicans are opposed to the war. If it's a Republican president, the Democrats are opposed to the war.
And they usually are anyway.
Which is what the case is. But although here there is, and I think everybody has alluded to this, there is a war weariness.
Yes, and it shows in the polls where the Pew Research Center found this past week for the first time an outright majority and a fairly distinct one, 56%, say it's time to get out as soon as possible. Let's just get out. Well, it takes a while just to get out, as we've heard many times. But at the same time, the president is loath to see anything terrible happen in Afghanistan, the collapse of the Karzai government, or, you know, something terrible happening across the line in Pakistan. I know, in quotes around the Karzai government or collapse, for that matter. But he's loath to see those things happen too soon.
Yes.
He doesn't want to see them happen before that magical fall of 2012, at least magical in his own mind. So we hear again about progress being made. All we need is a little bit more time. Some people on the hawkish side, including his military advisors, wanted to keep the troop level where it is today, over 100,000 uniform.
Now, forget about the hawkish side. Everybody is saying that General David Petraeus has been doing a tremendous job,
great job,
a successful job.
Everybody loves him.
And yet, apparently, the Obama speech on Wednesday night was contrary to what Petraeus would have liked.
Petraeus wanted to stand pat
and
keep the number of troops that he has advised up to now, and that is not terribly surprising. Quite a number of other people were supporting him, whatever he said, just basically whatever David Petraeus says should be our national policy. There was a fair fraction of the national argument that essentially was summed up as that. But I think that the dominant idea here is that that 56% is not going to come down anytime soon. It's probably going to cross the line over 60, and people don't believe we're really accomplishing as much in Afghanistan as they might have thought at one time. And here's the main thing. It's going to be 10 years this fall.
Yeah, yeah.
10 years.
Longest war in our history.
Longest war in our history.
If you include this week's podcast. Okay, but how about one war that nobody's talking about? We debated the pros and cons of Afghanistan. Why? You know, I know why nobody's talking about Libya.
What do you mean nobody's talking about it? The House is going to vote this week on several different resolutions that, while they may not have the force of law, are expressing their great unhappiness with the fact that we're involved in any way with NATO and Libya at all.
We're not involved. There are no hostilities.
Okay. I heard you make an excellent point about this on Talk of the Nation this week.
You listen to Talk of the Nation?
Slavishly. And then after I get home in the evening, of course, I listen to it again. But let me just say, you made an excellent point, which was, when you say there are no hostilities, you sacrifice the common sense mandate that applies to a national leader. How would you say there are no hostilities?
We're dropping bombs constantly. We're trying to kill.
We are not dropping bombs.
Oh, okay.
NATO.
Okay. We're supporting this effort, this so-called NATO effort.
Logistics.
Right.
Intelligence.
Money.
The bombs.
Right.
No. We're obviously up to our neck in it, but we don't have any
ground troops.
Boots right. on the ground.
That's right.
And therefore, it's not really hostilities in the view of the War Powers Resolution. I think that's a tortured interpretation, and so did the White House lawyers who told the president that's not going to pass the laugh test.
It's very, very
And the president overruled
it's
them.
It's very disappointing, yeah. Now, okay, now what happens, I mean, back to Libya, what happens when, let's say, those bombs do get Gaddafi? What do we do then? I mean, what's our policy? Who are we working with? Who are the good guys? Who forms the government? What then?
We don't really know what comes after Gaddafi, and that's probably the real reason that the president wonders how we got so far out on this rebellion against Gaddafi.
Wait. Days, not weeks. Remember that line?
Yeah, that's right. Days, not weeks. Right. We had no idea the guy was going to last as long as he did. And even then, we had doubts about the characters that are involved in this uprising. Some of them may have al-Qaeda ties. We know a lot of people came from Libya to take part in the uprising in Iraq. There are a lot of question marks here. So this is looking like a small policy move that the president thought would not be a terribly large risk that's turned into a much larger problem for him than he ever anticipated.
And isn't it interesting, though, to see that as many of the Republicans who were citing the War Powers Act, and in the past, with Republican presidents, they say, what War Powers Act?
Unconstitutional.
And Democrats, who always invoke the War Powers Act, how can we not, blah, 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 and they're saying, well, you know.
What about the Republicans who are running for president? What have they got to say about all this?
Well, they're mixed. It was Mitt Romney who said that we got to get out as soon as possible.
Of Afghanistan. They are pretty well united in criticizing the Libya policy, which is a bit more of shooting fish in a barrel. Right. But Afghanistan, which is something both parties have owned for nearly a decade, they're not real sure exactly how they want to deal with that. They don't exactly want to be on the side of saying, let's keep all the troops there who are there, when so many people are opposed to that in the general populace. At the same time, as good hard power Republicans, supporters of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, they don't exactly want to be pulling out when David Petraeus says we ought to stay in.
Well, one Democrat who announced for president this week who supports Obama all the way, John Huntsman.
This is my job, right, is to step in as an editor at this point here and say John Huntsman Jr. is not a Democrat.
He's not a Democrat.
No, he's never been a Democrat.
No.
He's from Utah.
But you notice that the Democratic National Committee and their allies are doing everything they can.
They're lackeys. They're running dogs.
No, but they basically are saying that John Huntsman is a Democrat who always has said great things about Obama, and it's just so
disingenuous. He said pretty nice things about Obama even as he was announcing for president against him.
The question each of us wants the voters to answer is who will be the better president, not who's the better American.
And we cannot have that in 2012. I'm mocking that, but of course, the Republican electorate, and I don't know if there's a criticism or not, but they're not in a forgiving mood. And we saw the anger in 2010. I suspect the anger will be even more so in 2012 because it's a presidential election. But to say civility, and I don't want to demonize, and of course, not everybody wants to demonize the president, but Newt Gingrich, when he announced for president, he was calling him a food stamp president. I mean, there's a lot of obnoxious and sometimes hurtful stuff coming out of the candidates, but John Huntsman does not believe in that. And does that fly in 2012?
I don't see how it does. As one of the editors here at NPR said last week, Huntsman has said he wants to take the high road to the White House. Does he realize it doesn't go there? And there is a real question mark as to whether or not you can run in this field, in this time, in these economic times in particular, as Mr. Nice Guy, which is kind of what he's trying to do. Have you seen the nice pictures of my kids? Yeah. Isn't that a beautiful family? How about these American flags? How about that Statue of Liberty? How about my civility?
Okay. How about that speech, though? What did he say?
You know what? He continues to say what he said in that speech. Yeah. Each day this week, he has made a statement on a major issue like Afghanistan, like Libya, where it is extraordinarily difficult to figure out what exactly he had. Have you seen the pictures of my kids? Those are great-looking kids. He doesn't really want to engage on the issues. He seems to be offering himself almost as a kind of personal alternative, as a White House occupant.
Well, he's either running for 2016, as a lot of people think, but at the same time, he also seemed to be the Democrats' favorite Republican. You know how the Democrats kept saying, if only Mitch Daniels would run. Now they're saying, if only John Huntsman would run. But I think they're damning him with faint praise, because ultimately, it's very possible that the White House does fear a John Huntsman nominee, except here's the problem, though. It's like, you know, Howard Baker. We said this
Are you interrupting yourself?
I am. I am interrupting myself.
That is my job.
But I'm thinking that, you know, the Democrats keep saying about how much they fear running against John Huntsman, but I don't know what that means anymore. They feared Howard Baker in 1980, and boy, if we could only run against Ronald Reagan, that right-wing crazy. So,
good call.
You know, be careful what you wish for. So I don't buy the argument. But I just don't see in this, and it's not only in 2012. I mean, you had the Paul Tsongas's of the world. You had the Dick Lugers of the world. Nice guys, ran for president, decent guys, and just didn't excite anybody. Mo Udall.
I think that's the point of the high road doesn't go there. One or two other interesting things that have happened on the presidential or near presidential front in the past week. More troubles for Newt Gingrich, that candidate you just mentioned as having kicked off his campaign in a rather less civil manner. How's that going for him?
Well, he lost two more fundraisers this week, which added to all the other folks he lost, the campaign manager, the campaign spokesman, the strategist.
On the bright side, though, apparently he got a second line of credit at Tiffany's.
Yeah, you know something? That to me is, there were so many things wrong with his candidacy that to make fun of the Tiffany thing, I think, maybe that's just emblematic of all his problems. But the thing is, he's not raising money. He still thinks that the way to get the nomination is to give speeches and to espouse ideas and not knock on doors in Iowa. And that's not how you win nominations.
All right.
But you know who's not going to be knocking on doors in Iowa is John Huntsman.
John Huntsman has said, I'm not going into Iowa. I think he blamed ethanol. And I think that does not hold any fuel of any kind for him because, among other things, ethanol has been declining as an issue in Iowa and doesn't have anywhere near the salience it once did. Even some of their own politicians say they ought to be weaned off of it. So that's not the reason he's not going to Iowa. And I'm not sure why he isn't going to Iowa. I think that's just a tactical mistake because it's a place where he could use that charm, use that civility to his own advantage and possibly do a little better than people expected and have some momentum going into New Hampshire where he hopes to do well with independents.
You don't have to win. Obviously, you don't have to win Iowa to win the nomination. You don't. George H.W. Bush finished third in 1988, won the nomination. John McCain finished fourth in 2008, won the nomination. But to say that you're not going to compete in Iowa, you're sending a message, I think, to religious conservatives saying, well, this is not my constituency. And if you're a Republican seeking the Republican nomination for president, to say that that's not your constituency, I think that you're setting yourself up for disappointment.
What if you're Rick Perry? Are you seeking the Republican nomination?
That's something I don't know the answer to.
I don't either. I'm not sure he does.
Well, that's
is there someone
too.
Making decisions for him, or is he entirely making this decision on his own?
I suspect the latter. You know, we keep reading about Dave Carney, one of the top strategists, who was a Rick Perry guy, who went to Gingrich, left Gingrich, and is already saying, we don't know what we're doing regarding Rick Perry, so you know where Dave Carney is. But I don't know if he really knows the answer. He says, is it too late? I don't think it's too late. There's still
not really
tons of debates coming up. I think you have, between now and October, you may have four or five. So just like we just got introduced to Michelle Bachmann last week.
And she's taken off.
She has. And Mitt Romney, you know, was said to have done well in his first debate. Rick Perry certainly has that opportunity to do it, but I just don't know if that's what he wants to do. And in some ways, I think of Fred Thompson, the fact that, is he willing to work for it?
You're going to rub Fred Thompson in again, aren't you?
That has nothing to do with...
Because I did take Fred Thompson fairly seriously 4 years ago.
That's not what I'm saying.
I will say this, while I know it's clearly a bruise, it's clearly something I still take kind of personally, I don't think Rick Perry has as much to offer as Fred Thompson could have had if he had had the fire in his considerable belly.
See, I've never seen Fred Thompson with fire in the belly. I have seen it with Rick Perry. I mean, he was very, very
effective.
He wanted
to beat Kay Bailey Hutchison.
He did overwhelmingly. Right?
And as we have said, if he were to get the Republican nomination, it would be the first time the party of Lincoln has nominated a person who has spoken favorably of secession.
Yes, but it's also to be the first time since 2004 that we had a Republican nominee from Texas. By the way, trivia stuff, did you know that in 1988, Rick Perry was the chairman, the Texas chairman?
For Al Gore.
Al Gore.
Of his primary campaign there in Texas, which he lost to Michael Dukakis. Now, that is not a propitious beginning for a political career to manage a campaign that loses to Michael Dukakis in Texas.
In the South.
In Texas.
Yeah, right.
And which is near the South. So, all right, one other ambivalent candidate we sometimes talk about, the former governor of Alaska, was on a bus tour, kind of lost a little bit of its media elevation, was kind of sinking a little bit, not getting as much attention. She went back to Alaska, and she says it's for jury duty.
But even more important than I don't want to omit Ron Paul, because this is going to come as a shock to you, but once again, Ron Paul has won a straw poll.
In the Republican Leadership Conference, right? Straw poll. A very strange strange straw poll down there in New Orleans
right.
last weekend. We know that this is a regional thing, uh-huh. even though they no longer have Southern in the name. Who finished second in that straw poll?
John Huntsman, who
and
did not show
And a very
up.
Strong
right.
second, in
You know
fact.
Who finished fifth or sixth?
Mitt Romney,
who won it last year.
Yeah. So
I don't know what it means.
I don't know what it means. I can understand why Ron Paul does well in these events, because the kinds of people who come out to these things in odd-numbered years are sometimes rather odd-numbered people. But let's just say for John Huntsman to finish a strong second makes no sense.
Right,
he wasn't
right.
there. Most people there probably didn't know who he was, couldn't have identified him in a lineup. I wonder about that straw poll.
But one more thing, and we've said this a million times, we always made the case in 2008 that, yes, Ron Paul has the ability to win straw polls, but will that translate into caucus votes and primary votes? It did not in 2008.
It never has.
This is a different Republican Party, and I know he's 75 years old, and maybe he's been eclipsed by the Michelle Bachmans of the world.
And he continues to support the legalization of marijuana, and when that fact is dropped into a discussion with most of the people who think that he's wonderful, it changes. The equation.
I think a lot of his positions are far more
libertarian. You think he's trying to crowd Gary Johnson in this?
Well, didn't he talk about heroin, perhaps, like the legal
of heroin
afraid, in the first
I'm
debate?
Afraid he says we should be not in the business of telling people what's illegal to do in the privacy of their own shooting gallery. So, Ron Paul, still a big question mark. What else do we really need to talk about?
Tim Pawlenty, just to finish off the field, Tim Pawlenty is the first candidate to air an ad in Iowa in advance of the August 13th straw poll in Ames.
Very important to him because he is contested there by Michelle Bachmann, his fellow Minnesotan, but in her case, born in Iowa and deep family roots there.
And will announce her, officially announce her candidacy in the coming days in Waterloo.
That's right. All right, quickly, we don't generally talk too much about redistricting because it puts people to sleep even faster than the rest of the podcast, but there are several interesting redistricting stories.
First of all, let me just interrupt. We are going to be talking about redistricting in detail this year because I think it's a great... Ron, honey, I'm home. How was your day? Ron, it's a great story, redistricting. Oh, God. Okay, the reason I love redistricting is because it's drama, it's trauma, it's fighting for your seat.
You're a sick person.
It often has nothing to do with constituency. It has to do with currying favor with state legislators. But anyway, the latest news is we always knew that New York would lose two congressional seats, a Republican upstate, a Democratic downstate.
Anthony Weiner.
Well, that's the thing. We didn't know what Democrat would have to be sacrificed
Anthony
now
Weiner.
That Anthony Weiner has given the Democrats a thank you farewell, as opposed to the other notes he was sending them in the past. They now know that that is a seat that can disappear very quickly, so that solves the Democrats' dilemma in New York. In California, the news this week, in the 6th District, Lynn Woolsey surprisingly announced that she's not going to run for re-election in 2012 after 20 years. And
one reason may be that?
Redistricting. There are a lot of incumbents in California, like David Dreyer, whose district is far more Democratic, like Bob Filner of San Diego, who's going to quit Congress, run for mayor of San Diego.
That's a funny thing that he thinks he can better represent the city and be closer to the political middle of that city by running for mayor than by staying in his own district.
Because his district was being merged with Susan Davis. So in other words, there's a lot of amazing stories going on. I could talk about it forever.
There's a very interesting phenomenon here.
Ron, I want to invite all the listener over to my house, maybe tonight or this weekend, so we can just talk about redistricting.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Leave a light on and we'll
right.
So the question here is, is this going to be a fundamentally different redistricting year because just of what's going on in California and Florida? In both those states, there's been tremendous incumbent protection over the years, over the decades, so much so that in California you have over the last, say, 5 cycles, 10 years, in those 5 elections, 260 House elections, and what? Fewer than 5 incumbents have lost?
Maybe fewer than 3, exactly.
260
right.
House elections in just the last decade.
Because there was a little wink in the state legislature.
Exactly.
Look, I'll protect the Republicans,
exactly.
You protect the Democrats. But now there's a nonpartisan redistricting commission that throws out partisanship, that throws out politics.
That's right. And in Florida, they've forbidden the protection of incumbents. And so you've got a lot of people there being thrown into
right.
each other's districts.
Right.
This is an interesting potential breakthrough in American politics, because if you created a house in which people actually had to be responsive to members of both parties back in their home district because they had to worry about people who were in both or either party or independents, that would be a very different House of Representatives. Lots fewer people serving for decade after decade, generation after generation. It could be a new ballgame.
But then you have states like Illinois where the Democrats control everything and a lot of Republicans are in deep, deep trouble in that state. You have Republicans in charge in Missouri and Indiana where Democratic incumbents are on the run.
So still business as usual. A couple of Senate races where there have been some dynamics in the last week. In California, Dianne Feinstein looking at some weak numbers for her in such a blue state.
You know something, I mean, I still can't think of a Republican who could beat her. I don't even know a Republican who's even running. There's always been rumors that Dianne Feinstein might want to give it up.
She could retire.
She could if this poll is as damaging to her as some people think. But again, I don't see what Republican comes out of this with a Senate win. I think the last Republican to win a Senate seat there was Pete Wilson in 1988. It's been a while since a Republican won a Senate seat there.
That's right. And it is difficult to imagine anyone beating her, but it's not that hard to imagine her deciding that after a lifetime in politics in California, it would be time for her to reap some rewards and retire.
Especially if the conventional wisdom is that the Republicans take control of the Senate in 2012, which I'm not convinced it happens.
But it is the conventional wisdom. Okay, and besides California, some interesting things going on in Utah.
Well, this is not new news, and the fact is that Orrin Hatch, who's been in the Senate since 1977, is likely to be facing a primary challenge with Jason Chaffetz, a two-term congressman, very, very conservative.
Still pretty hot. Still pretty hot.
Loved by the Tea Party. There's a new poll out this week that had, among Republicans, Hatch only up by 3 points. But here's the thing. In Utah, they don't have primaries. They have conventions. And as Robert Bennett learned in 2010...
Hardest of the hard.
The conservatives run that system. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then Hatch could be in deep trouble.
But it's not the poll in the end that matters. It's who shows up at that convention. So an icon of conservatism in Congress and in the Senate back over the last generation, in danger back in his home state again for not being conservative enough. He's jumped on the Tea Party bandwagon, but he might just not have been on it soon enough.
And a similar problem is what Dick Lugar is facing in Indiana. Been around a long time, also elected in 1976, facing a far more conservative challenger.
Richard Murdoch, maybe not as much a house of fire as Jason Chaffetz, but a formidable candidate insofar as he has clearly harnessed the Tea Party horse. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Yes, you are. Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.